The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The competition for admission into a top-tier college or university is sometimes compared to an arms race and can cost tens of thousands of dollars in test prep courses or tutors. In our data-driven, quantifiable society, a high SAT score is one of the most powerful weapons in that battle for placement. Harvard Law's Lonnie Guineer wants to change all that. She says the SAT is a more accurate measure of wealth and ethnicity than how well a student will do in college. We are living in a testocracy, she charges in a new book, and coaching kids to choose one right answer on a test cannot prepare them for the kind of creative, collaborative approaches essential to solving the problems of our complicated world. Lonnie Guineer is the first woman of color to be given tenure at Harvard Law School. She is a longtime civil rights advocate, author of several books, most recently The Tyranny of the Meritocracy, Democratizing Higher Education in America. Lonnie Guineer, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you make the charge that we're not living in a meritocracy, but a testocracy. Now, what do you mean by that?
I mean that people are measuring their ability, their potential contribution through their outcome on standardized tests that are not necessarily the best way of determining what a person's strength is or what their commitments are. And so I'm suggesting that the way in which we think about merit in the context of the contribution that our students have the potential of making, and how do we cultivate and master that potential in service of democracy.
And chief among these standardized tests that you take to task in the book is the SAT, developed in the early 20th century by social scientists really to limit enrollment. Can you tell us a little bit about the origins of that test?
I do know that it was used by many of the upper-class schools as a way of determining the students that they would admit. And what they were essentially doing was equating one's ability to do well on the SAT with one's ability to pay for college. And the SAT, it turns out, was not really a good predictor of how people would do in college. It was simply a barrier that was being used to determine who would get into college.
Well, let's look at that a little bit deeper. Your argument is that the SAT is actually a wealth test, right? You chart the relationship between SAT scores and family wealth and ethnicity and level of parental education, with African-Americans, Mexican-Americans, Hispanic and Puerto Rican scoring much lower than whites or Asians.
But also low-income whites.
Well, low-income whites. Well, but there's a theory about why this happens, and it's the stereotype threat. Now, this is illustrated by a young man that you knew named Enrique. Tell us about his story.
This is a brilliant guy who worked with me on a number of projects, and he took the SAT practice, the LSAT, excuse me, 30 times practicing, and he still didn't do particularly well on the LSAT, yet he was just brilliant. He had a an amazing memory. He could tell you where a particular word was, not only on what page, but where on the page it was. And it was my sense that he felt so stressed by the test that he didn't perform in a way that he was capable of performing.
Well, Ivy League colleges and universities want the Enriques, or at least they say, to diversify their student population, right? You know, I think you spoke to an admissions officer at Harvard that said that. How then, without the SAT, do colleges and universities identify those who will be, quote, successful students?
My point of the book is that it's not just whom do we admit, but what is it that we're measuring and valuing in terms of the contribution that those people that we admit will ultimately make to a larger society? The issue is not just what's the basis for getting into college, but what's the point of college in the first place? And here's where I borrow from David Laboure, who's a professor at Stanford in the education school, that the mission of higher education is not clear, but it should be. And one, in my view, one of the important missions of higher education is that you want citizens who are going to contribute to the community and to the nation, not just people who are going to make a lot of money because they did well on the LSAT or the SAT.
So in proposing this, you know, you're talking about a different definition of success, you know, be a productive, engaged citizen, as you put it. Now people, in success in America to so many means individual gain. I mean, graduates are under a lot of pressure to get a job, to make enough money to pay back their student loans. So this is so much bigger than just how we define success, right?
It's bigger than how we define success, but the example of how we define it may make that larger issue more understandable, or at least make citizens more aware of it. And that is, in the Harvard Crimson several years ago, they had an article, "Show Him the Money," was the title of it. And it was about men who go to college at Harvard and then end up going on Wall Street are the more successful compared to the women whom they were criticizing, because the women spend so much of their time doing good, going and becoming teachers or trying to become doctors. I think that's part of the problem. It's not just focused in the SAT or the LSAT. It's a preoccupation with competitive individualism as opposed to collaborative solution making or collaborative solution thinking.
Well, that begins with the individual, and you point out in the book that there's this deeply embedded notion of merit among the elites that is different from the elites of the past. How does that affect the argument that you make that the new meritocracy is not equipped for solving, you know, the complicated, in need of collaboration problems of today?
Because it's focused on competitiveness, and competitiveness in a way that each individual is competing with each other individual. They're not working together. But the examples that I draw from are a physics professor, Eric Mazur, and a calculus professor who are working with students and learning from the students that the best way to teach students is to have them teach each other, and that teaching each other means explaining to others, you know, what the challenges are, where they may have holes in their argument, and working together improves the performance of both the person who's quote-unquote the teacher and the person who's quote-unquote the student. In Eric Mazur's case, he had a problem with women in the physics area, but when he had the women and the men working together with, you know, other students, the women's grades started to go up. Same thing with Marie Treisman. He was concerned about the performance of black students at UC Berkeley at the time. He found that the way the Chinese-American students were studying, where they were talking about the calculus problems over a meal, where they were as a group trying to work through the problems, that was a format that not only benefited the Chinese-American students, but when used by the African-American students, benefited them too, so that it was a focus on collaborative merit.
What is the incentive then for colleges and universities? I mean, some schools have decreased or eliminated reliance on the SAT for admissions and have paid a price in the almighty U.S. News and World Report's annual ranking. So what's the incentive for them to give up this current system of measuring merit?
Well, I think the incentive system is the needs of a democracy, and that the universities are crucial to ensuring that the United States remains a democracy. And by democracy, I don't just mean that they have elections. I mean that they have people participating in a civic-minded community spirit to solve problems that are not only facing individuals, but facing groups of people, whether it's an issue related to the amount of water available or an issue related to the amount of food people can afford, that we have to think broader about the contributions that college graduates have the potential of making that is going to help our country and the people in our country, not just help the individual who graduated from college.
Lani Guinier, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me to speak with you.
Lani Guinier is the first woman of color to be given tenure at Harvard Law School, a longtime civil rights advocate, author of several books, most recently, The Tyranny of the Meritocracy, Democratizing Higher Education in America. You'll find much more about the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we're going to stay in the realm of higher education for the next installment of The Uncommon Core. That's our series highlighting offbeat courses offered at colleges and universities across the country. Today, from designing courses to managing the green, a Texas professor can teach you everything you need to know about golf, except how to play it.
Hi, my name is Dr. Cummings, and I'm the associate professor at Tarleton State University. And I focus in turf grass management and weed science. There is a split between students that like to play golf and students interested in horticulture. But I think that sometimes there's a blend of both. I think it is important to be able to play golf to understand the rules and the concerns of the players.
Vern, this is extremely difficult. This is one of the toughest pitches on the entire place here. There's a good chance he doesn't get this inside the Marco's ball.
Most students are surprised how much math there is. There's math that has to go with how much product is needed for a certain area. There's math to calibrate sprayers and spreaders to help apply those products correctly. There's math to determine how much water is needed for a certain area. I want my students to be able to answer four questions. I want them to be able to tell somebody what type of grass they should plant.
How about some Poa annua grass?
What type of fertilizer they should use.
I'd recommend ammonium sulfate.
How to control a weed.
Gotta make sure to get it out of the root zone.
And how to affix a bare spot.
Wait, what's a bare spot?
And the bare spot is always an interesting question at a cocktail party or something like that. We should all be able to come up with a reason for a bare spot that someone else didn't come up with.
So where do you think this bare spot came from?
Could be the mower blade needs sharpening. Ooh, could be a pest problem.
I blame big government. Cheers.
I don't really play golf. I'm not a self-starter when it comes to golf. I play by invitation. I get plenty of invitations from old students to come play their golf courses because they're so proud and want me to see how they've learned. And that they've really upped their game and much more appreciative than they were in class sometimes.
This crowd has gone deadly silent. Cinderella story, out of nowhere, a former greenskeeper now about to become the Masters champion.
It looks like I'm a wreck. It's in the hole!
There's all different types of golf courses for all different types of budget and all different types of players. A person needs to decide if they're going to be interested in a cool season putting green like creeping bent grass or a warm season putting green like Bermuda grass. And then there's different golf courses that they could enter. They could be on a resort course, a country club course, or a municipal course. And they should begin getting their experience in the course they want to end up at.
Son of a ball, why didn't you just go home? That's your home! Are you too good for your home? Answer me!
I get excited when the students get excited, but sometimes I have to lead the excitement. And I think it's what a difference a day can make, how much change you can bring to an area and how the plants respond to the management you give it. A lot of people say plants grow in search of water and nutrients, but plants respond. All plants can do is respond, and they respond to the management we give them. They respond to the mowing. They respond to the water. They respond to the light. So any way somebody could say a plant is searching for something, a person could say it's responding to something.
The Uncommon Core is produced by Taylor Quimby, and you can learn more about Professor Cummings and his golf courses on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, an unorthodox approach to a traditional staple of collegiate sports. A cheerleading squad at one of the country's preeminent women's colleges is raising eyebrows with its short skirts and perky attitudes. That story when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts is among the nation's preeminent women's colleges, an alma mater to several notable feminists, including Gloria Steinem and Betty Friedan. So one thing people do not expect to find on campus is cheerleaders. The Smith Spirit Squad is bucking the cheerleading stereotype and raising questions about women's roles in athletics and who owns the definition of feminist anyway. Karen Brown brings us the story.
Take it to the floor. Come on, Smith, let's soar. Take it to the floor.
Much better.
Come on, Smith, let's soar.
Should we just do that every time?
Yeah, that looks good.
About two dozen young women in tank tops and sweatpants are lined up in two rows, learning to chant and clap in unison. They're holding cheerleading practice on a grassy field outside the campus gym.
How does that feel?
That was good.
This is the Smith College Spirit Squad, a two-year-old team of women who cheer on other women from the sidelines at rugby, volleyball, and basketball games. Unlike traditional co-ed sports schools, this squad is mostly made up of women who had never cheered before, like Nicole Rothenberger.
I went to a high school where cheerleading was very stereotypical, very catty, and I definitely had a lot of mixed feelings about joining the cheering squad just because I'd been an upper-level gymnast, and a lot of times you're either a cheerleader or you're definitely against cheerleading.
Rothenberger's teammates also say it took some self-convincing to even try out. 19-year-old Alex Golden had been a jock in high school.
Well, I never saw myself as a cheerleader. I always saw myself as, you know, a varsity athlete, softball player.
And Lorna Sylvester was a drama kid who made fun of the cheerleaders.
Oh, we used to just, like, call them ditzes and airheads. And
so how do you figure you guys are not like that?
Well, the sheer fact that this is Smith College, I think, provides a little bit of intelligence to the squad.
The majority of Smith cheerleaders are science majors. What got them to put on the red and black mini-skirted uniforms was the realization that this cheering squad is a twist on the stereotype. Again, Nicole Rothenberger.
It's a very different atmosphere cheering for a women's college, cheering with women who are so academically focused, but at the same time want to show their spirit and enthusiasm for athletics on Smith College.
But while these women have made peace with their preconceptions of pom-poms, the same cannot be said of the entire Smith community. This fall, when Smith officials posted a video of the Spirit Squad on the college's Facebook page, a lively discussion ensued. Current students and recent graduates were largely supportive, but many older alumnae were shocked.
My gut reaction was, I can't believe there's cheerleaders at Smith.
Lisa Hyder graduated from Smith in 1983 on the heels of the failed Equal Rights Amendment. She was among those chiming in on the Facebook page, most raising questions about the school's feminist credentials.
Saying, well, you have to understand that we're coming from a different place, and cheerleaders to us, it's sort of the anti-feminist ideal of the pretty woman cheering on the guys to victory while they're out there on the field actually doing something. And sometimes it seems to me like young women today take for granted some of the things that feminists fought for.
If anything, I would say the Spirit Squad is pro-feminist in the sense that we're a group of strong women supporting strong women.
Cheerleader Nicole Rothenberger.
And in my view, feminism is more about being able to have freedom and having not having boundaries set in front of you. And by people saying, you know, cheerleading is, you know, not feminist, and that's like setting a boundary, saying we can't do it.
Bridging the feminist generation gap is not the only challenge for these neophyte cheerleaders. There's also the jumping, yelling, dancing, and gravity-defying human pyramids.
See how we're all doing it at different times? Okay, let's like go through it at regular pace. Okay.
Smith hired cheerleading coach Garnett Sherry, who has trained more traditional cheerleaders at co-ed schools, to bring the team up to professional standards. She says the women are certainly smart and committed enough to learn the moves. They just need to move beyond their cerebral tendencies and embrace the showmanship.
When it comes to them being naturally excited, that was something that we had to practice. They had to get over that fear of being judged and really take on the role of leading a crowd and being confident in what they were doing, regardless if it felt kind of silly or awkward. They realized that they got a much more positive response.
None of these women are planning a career with the Dallas Cowboys, but they say they're proud of how far they've come. Last year, the Smith Spirit Squad had only 9 members and still won the award for Best Student Organization. This year, the squad has almost tripled in size, and the stunts are getting more elaborate with every game. I'm Karen Brown.
Beat the rivals!
Let's focus on clapping together, too.
And the studies continue on Word of Mouth. Up next, we're going to hear from a husband and wife research team who are giving their lifeblood to stop the bed bug epidemic. That's after the news when Word of Mouth continues in just a moment.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you or anyone you know has ever had bed bugs, you know it is like landing in a horror movie that can take months to escape from. A pair of researchers has developed a chemical attractant that could help lure bed bugs into traps and put the bed bug epidemic to sleep for good. To do it involved a human sacrifice. Well, we'll get more on that from the husband and wife team of Regina and Gerhard Gries. They're biologists at Simon Fraser University in Canada and join us now to talk more about their work. Hello, Regina.
Hello.
And hello to you, Gerhard.
Hello, and thanks for having us.
Well, really glad you could speak with us. It's a fascinating area of research, and there are so many possible areas of research in biology. Regina, I'm wondering what made you want to tackle the bed bug problem?
Here in Vancouver, bed bugs are really a serious problem, and we felt already a long time we should try to find something to lure them into a trap. That's what we do for many insects. We develop like attractants or repellents. We wanted to help the public and find a solution to stop the epidemic.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so they were lured in with this chemical attractant that you developed. But I'd like to talk a little bit more about the sacrifice that had to be made in order to develop it. Namely, Regina, can you tell us what you had to do in order to ensure that you would have subjects for your study?
Yeah, in order to get these chemicals from the bugs themselves, you have to have a large colony so you can accumulate these chemicals. In order to keep a colony, you have to have a somebody to feed them. And I started to feed them about 5 years ago. In the beginning, I mean, it's a bit gross. When they bite, it stings a bit,
mm-hmm.
and it's a bit itchy. I still have a bit of swelling, and I get red spots, but they disappear in 2 days. So it was, I fed first also maybe 200 per week, and then I fed 500 and 1,000, and then maybe the most I fed was like 3,000 per week.
Oh my goodness, you're feeding, what'd you do, do you just lie there and let them bite
you? No. Yeah, that's also what people can hardly understand. So I have the bed bugs in jars. There's filter paper in there for them to sit on, and when it's feeding time, I put a screen on those jars held with a rubber band,
wow.
and then I just turn the jar around and onto my lower forearm, and they bite through the screen. And when they are finished in about 10 minutes, I take them off and they go back into the jars.
Well, because there are two of you, you know, a husband and wife team of biologists engaged in the same kind of research. I'm just curious how the decision was made that Regina should be the be the human sacrifice.
Well, at the very beginning, of course, we wanted to feed the bed bugs on animal blood because that would be the easiest solution. We very quickly realized that the bed bugs feeding on animal blood didn't perform that well in slaughterhouses, and twice it was so that our entire colony nearly collapsed, and that was, so we assumed, due to medication that these animals had received, and then the bed bugs couldn't stomach the medication.
Uh-huh.
So for all these reasons, we then decided that we really wanted to proceed and feed the bed bugs on ourselves, and every team member really wanted to chip in and help out with the feeding. But as it turned out, we all showed really bad reactions to the feeding. For myself, I can say that after feeding sessions, a couple of feeding sessions, my forearms were swelling to almost twice their normal size, so mm-hmm. we really had to stop doing this. And then luckily for us, Regina was the only team member that showed very insignificant reactions to the feeding, and then unintentionally she became the host to feed them while for many years now. And I must admit, I had many teasing responses from my colleagues, like, how convenient is that? But that's the way it was, and luckily for us, it worked out at the end.
Bedbug infestations have cost cities like New York City, Boston, and others millions of dollars in replacement costs and eradication costs. Well, we're talking to a pair of researchers and biologists at Simon Fraser University in Canada, Regina and Gerhard Gries. They are a husband and wife team who've been working on this problem for a long time. So you and Regina and Robert Britton, your colleague, all worked on this. How effective is this set of chemical attractants that you've discovered and developed when it comes to attracting bedbugs into a trap, I guess, they can't escape from?
Yeah, we have started out, of course, testing this in the laboratory, and it was a long quest to really have the right composition of chemicals. Just to give you a bit of background on the chemical composition of this pheromone blend, there are five airborne or volatile components that emanate from the feces, particularly of the bed bugs. So once they have fed on a human, then they start to digest the blood. They defecate, and from the feces, these volatile components, pheromone components, emanate, and they attract the bed bugs to the shelter. So mm-hmm. what you want to realize is bed bugs go through several developmental stages, and they mold from stage to stage. They cast off the old skin, the old suit that has become too tight, and then they have a new one that accommodates the bigger size. And in this cast skin, there is the arrestment-causing pheromone component, histamine. So when they realize the presence of histamine, it indicates to them this is a good, safe place to mold. It also indicates that there's a host nearby, because somebody must have fed on that host. And when they realize the histamine is present, they will then adopt that shelter. And so these five volatile components and the one less volatile component, histamine, make up the chemical message that the bed bugs utilize among themselves.
Mm.
And what we have done, once we had evidence that this was working in the laboratory, we have then taken this lure and have tested it in infested apartments. So there was a very good correlation between trap captures and the presence of bed bugs, and that means that this bait and trap will be a really good effective detection tool for people, for tenants, for homeowners, to give them indication whether or not there really is a bed bug problem.
Well, first of all, one of the things that strikes me is that, you know, when people get treated for bed bugs, I've known a couple of them who got them from, you know, very swanky hotels, I might add. They've had these huge, terrible chemical treatments. Now, I understand that part of your work is actually figuring out whether there is a bed bug infestation in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely, because quite often landlords and homeowners may experience insect bites, particularly at night. And in our many experiments we have run in apartments, the tenant had come to a landlord asking for treatment against bed bugs, but nobody really knew or was sure whether these were bed bugs. Quite often the tenants would sleep with the window open and then mosquitoes at night coming in and doing the biting. Or in quite a few other cases, the bites actually came from fleas. So it's very important to make sure that you really have bed bugs. Or if you are concerned about picking up bed bugs from public transit, libraries, movie theaters, you name them, you want to have a tool that constantly tells you, okay, you are safe, there are no bed bugs in your house. So the primary objective of the research we have done that far is to was to have a really effective detection tool, affordable and effective detection tool. What we now plan on doing is to see how we can couple this pheromone with other control technologies so that you have the best possible eradication method available to you. And that is the next stage of the research that we are about to enter now.
Well, congratulations. I mean, you two will be held up as heroes, I'm sure, for many people who've been through this. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Regina, thank you very much for offering yourself for this research.
Thank you. Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah.
Regina and Gerhard Gries, they are biologists at Simon Fraser University in Canada, where they've been developing a set of chemical attractants that could help end the bed bug epidemic. You can read much more about their work at wordofmouthradio.org. It was meant to be a model for modern living, but the public housing project known as Pruitt-Igoe, built in downtown St. Louis in the 1950s, quickly became a nightmare. Roman Mars from the podcast 99% Invisible brings us the story.
These developments are run by the St. Louis Housing Authority. This is a far cry from the crowded, collapsing tenements that many of these people have known. Here in bright new buildings with spacious grounds, they can live.
Pruitt-Igoe myth begins here.
They can live.
This is Chad Fredericks.
So Pruitt-Igoe was a public housing project that existed on the north side of St. Louis.
Chad Fredericks is the director and producer of the documentary, The Pruitt-Igoe Myth.
It was 33 11-story buildings, and it was part of a larger urban renewal campaign that the city was undergoing in the 1940s and 50s.
It was touted as a solution, a cure for the disease.
It was viewed kind of as a replacement for low-rise tenement housing.
People who had been living where they literally never saw the sun.
And so Pruitt-Igoe was supposed to be everything different.
Now they would have more magnificent views than the richest people in St. Louis.
It was high-rise, whereas the private market housing was low-rise. It was federal, and therefore you wouldn't have the creeping influence of slumlords coming in and basically being derelict landowners. It was an opportunity to present poor residents with light and air. That was really the driving factor behind Pruitt-Igoe's design.
Tall, modern buildings would give access to fresh breezes and sunlight, the sensible remedy to the unhealthy conditions in the inner city slums.
At least that was the thinking.
Pruitt-Igoe would rise above the polluted slums.
It was a very beautiful place, like a big hotel resort, I'd say, with plenty of green grass, trees, shrubbery, and all the works.
What happened?
Well, one day we woke up and it was all gone.
In the middle 50s, St. Louis thought it had solved its low-cost housing needs, but instead a monster was created.
The project became notorious quickly. High crime, shocking vandalism. And just two decades after opening Pruitt-Igoe, the government gave up.
Because they are so desperate, they are willing to try desperate things.
The Housing Authority blew it up. The press was invited. It started with three buildings in 1972. The rest followed. The image of the implosion with the St. Louis Gateway Arch in the background became infamous. Bad architecture is one of the major cited reasons for why Pruitt-Igoe failed. But that actually isn't a factor that Chad Fredericks puts a lot of stock in.
Architecture was a marginal influence, if any, on Pruitt-Igoe's demise. I don't like to try to take Pruitt-Igoe out of the city of St. Louis and what it went through in those years.
What St. Louis went through was a completely unpredicted population decline.
The understanding among city planners and city officials was that the population would continue to rise from 800,000 to a population of about 1 million from 1950 to 1970.
What happened was the exact opposite.
The bottom dropped out of the city's population as populations started to move to suburban areas out of the city, to the point where by 1980, St. Louis had half the population that it did in 1950.
And that trend continues to this day.
What happens is you build this massive project to house all these people who are coming into the city, and when those people don't come and the people who you intended to be living there move out, all of a sudden you have a vacancy crisis, and that's really what gripped St. Louis during these years.
So given that, the major architectural or design flaw that Chad attributes to the demise of Pruitt-Igoe was the sheer scale of the project.
It was built so big, and there just simply weren't enough people to populate it by the 1970s.
The scale doomed Pruitt-Igoe from the start. The high vacancy rate meant that the housing authority couldn't collect enough money to pay the maintenance bills.
The money for operating and maintaining the buildings was to come from the incomes of the rents from the tenants.
Things began to break, conditions deteriorated, more people left, less rent could be collected, everything just got worse and worse.
To me, it had very little to do with the fact that Pruitt-Igoe was public housing, very little to do with the fact that it was high rise. It had almost everything to do with the decline of the city in which it resided.
And that story was produced by Roman Mars for the podcast 99% Invisible. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The recent announcement that Woody Allen would produce a TV show for the Amazon Prime streaming service provoked some harsh words in the media. The Daily Beast, Jezebel, and the Washington Post questioned the choice of a writer and a director accused by his daughter of being a pedophile. Vox culture editor Todd Vanderwerf wrote about the historic deal, which he says is remarkably stupid for another reason. Star power buzz has become more important than the programs that they produce. And Todd Vanderwerf, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hello, it's good to be here.
Well, did I get that right? In an industry that says it's all about the content, the excitement of a big name seems to be more important in this case.
Yeah, you know, and that big name is coming in two different ways. The one that we're all sort of familiar with is that a network picks up a property because it's based on a movie or based on a pre-existing TV show or book, and they say, we're going to produce this because people know this name. And that's how we end up with things like the upcoming possible sitcom based on the movie Big.
Right.
But this is one where people say, this is an actor people know, this is a director people know, and people are going to be really excited to have this person go from movies to TV. And that big name will sell this show in and of itself. And that's what we have with Woody Allen.
Well, there are a number of A-list directors now doing TV, or Martin Scorsese, Steven Soderbergh, David Fincher, David Lynch, all TV products airing or in the works. So with what degree of success in most cases? I mean, Boardwalk Empire was a critical hit, right? Did the ratings matter?
The ratings for Boardwalk Empire steadily dropped with every season, which was weird because I thought it got better as it went along. I think the first season, which is the one Scorsese was the most involved with, if he was super involved with that show ever, was probably the worst season of the show. It was very slow moving and it didn't really have a lot in the way of story momentum. So it definitely was something where it felt like that show got better as it got more TV-like, which I think was to its credit. Now, David Lynch is definitely an interesting case because I think Twin Peaks is sort of the gold standard for something like this. But that was a situation where he signed up with a TV producer and they figured out what this looked like as a TV show, and they created one of the best shows of all time.
It's so interesting talking to you about this because often we do hear of programs from The Wire to early Mad Men to Boardwalk Empire adored by critics that just don't deliver audience. You actually make the point in your piece that ratings don't matter to these prestige services. How can that be?
Well, something like Netflix or Amazon is really only interested in if they can get and keep you as a subscriber. And that is something that is, you know, far more tricky to measure than ratings. Like, for instance, think about Netflix's show Orange is the New Black. Mm-hmm. We don't know how many people watch that, but let's say there's, you know, 50,000 of them. But let's say all 50,000 of those people only subscribe to Netflix to watch Orange is the New Black. Does that cover their production costs on that show? It probably not. But it's probably a thing where they're like, we want to keep these people as subscribers, so let's keep bringing this show back so they'll keep subscribing. Now, obviously, far, far, far more people than 50,000 people watch Orange is the New Black, but that gives you an idea of their thinking.
Right.
It's one of those things where a lot of this is sort of based on building a good brand name and having good buzz. And if you want to look at the ultimate example of this, you have HBO. On pay cable, which is a very similar business model in that it wants to have you call your cable company and say, I want HBO, and then pay the $15 a month or whatever it is you pay for HBO.
I'm going to get back to Woody Allen, and I admit being one of the longtime fans whose bitter disappointment about his personal life was fueled by my misapprehension that his affable character in his movies is his character in real life. And I'm thinking, if you were to say to me, what does Woody Allen think of television? I would think of this scene from Annie Hall, right? Here's Woody's character. He's in Hollywood. He's visiting his friend Max, played by Tony Roberts, as he supervises the laugh track for his TV sitcom.
Max, do you realize how immoral this all is?
Max, I got a hit series.
But you're adding fake laughs.
What are you doing home so early? Arnie.
Yeah,
give me a tremendous laugh here, Tommy. Do the show live in front of an audience.
Right, but nobody laughs at it because the jokes aren't funny.
Yeah, well, that's why this machine is dynamite.
Now that, to me, is Woody Allen on television. And in typical self-deprecating form, after the Amazon deal was announced, he said, I don't know how I got into this. I have no idea where to begin. I have no ideas. Could he make a great TV show, do you think, Todd?
Oh, for sure. I mean, he's Woody Allen. He's made any number of great movies. And whatever I think, again, of his personal life, he's certainly someone who has made some really strong films. Television is different from film. It has a different skill set. But I look at the show Louie, which is very Woody Allen-esque, and that's from Louis C.K. and airs on FX. And I think, you know, this is something Woody Allen could easily do if he decided to make basically a series of short films. I think he'd be in fine form. I think he'd be just fine. But it's certainly a thing where, yes, his career has always struck me as the sort of person where if you ran into him at a New York dinner party would probably say, oh, I don't even own a television, when like talked with about some of the big things that have happened on TV in the last few years.
So can a film director successfully cross over to the smaller medium of television?
You know, it's difficult because television is so based around writers. It's based around the voice of the writer, and film is based around directors. And you know, there are so many differences between the two mediums in terms of how they tell stories, in terms of how they structure stories. Although interestingly, those are sort of starting to disappear. Like if you look at the Marvel superhero movies in the film world, those are structured much more similarly to a TV show than you might think. And that's created sort of an interesting hybrid form that is moving toward each other, where I wouldn't be surprised if in, you know, 30 years these two are sort of very much more similar. But right now there's not a great track record. You know, there are some who have done it, but mostly because they've hooked up with really experienced TV people. I expect Amazon to sort of give Woody Allen a consigliere in the world of television, and we'll see if that happens. And I think that'll sort of make the difference.
Well, I don't think we can ignore the radioactive element of Woody Allen right now. Of course, the accusation of sexual abuse by his daughter, Dylan, made public last year. The reason that a lot of people were angered by this deal, one headline I read, why shun Bill Cosby and offer Woody Allen a TV deal? Of course, their levels of their accusation are very different. But, you know, should Amazon be getting into business with Woody Allen?
I don't think so personally. You know, I think that is a thing where his name has certainly been tarnished for me in many ways. And I've loved a lot of his movies. I continue to love those movies. But he himself as a person I find sort of odious at this point. But it's definitely a situation where I see why they're doing it, because, you know, as much as it offends me, as much as it's something I don't like, there are plenty of people who just don't care or haven't heard. So I understand why it happened, while thinking it's sort of disheartening to have it happen. And And I understand why people are more willing to give him the benefit of the doubt than someone like Bill Cosby. But it's definitely a sad situation all around.
Okay, so in closing, Woody Allen says, my guess is that the Amazon Studios chief, Roy Price, is going to regret this. What do you think, Todd Vanderwerf?
You know, I'm going to hope for the best and hope that the show is pretty good. But I will be enormously surprised if it is as good as some of his best films.
Todd Vanderwerf, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Todd is culture editor for Vox. He's former TV editor for the Onion AV Club. And you can read his article. Great for the title itself. Amazon's deal with Woody Allen is historic and remarkably stupid. We have a link at wordofmouthradio.org.
God, it's so clean out here.
It's because they don't throw their garbage away. They make it into television shows.
Oh, come on, Max. Give us a break, will you? It's Christmas.
Thanks so much for your listening time today. There's plenty more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us. You can send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. We find the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. Make sure and share yours. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.